From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Police chiefs like myself are having to work 100 times harder now because of the bad policies that are being packaged as public safety, when in fact it does nothing but harm public safety.
Is a new Show Me Your Papers law hurting public safety in Texas even before it goes into effect September 1st? We'll go to Houston, the most diverse city in the country, to speak with its first Latino police chief, Art Acevedo, who has already seen a decrease in Latino victims reporting rape, even as rapes reported by non-Latinos increase. Then we look at how thousands of African-American homeowners may have been illegally forced out of their homes in Detroit.
What many of you and many people in general aren't really familiar with is the property tax foreclosure crisis that's currently happening in Detroit, which activists on the ground are calling a hurricane with no water. And that's because it is, in fact, wiping out large swaths of poor and working class African American communities, just as Hurricane Katrina did.
And we'll go to Charlottesville, Virginia, where white nationalists are planning to rally to protest Charlottesville's decision to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee. We'll speak with Charlottesville's only African-American city councilor. He led the effort to take down the Civil War memorial.
We have to ask ourselves one simple question. We can disagree about statues. We can disagree about different things that are going on in the city. But one thing that we must do is ask ourselves, can we rally together in the name of love? Can we rally to show that our city is one that will band together to push out hate?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Soaring temperatures could make parts of South Asia too hot for human survival by 2100. That's according to new research by scientists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who say as many as 1.5 billion people live in areas that could become uninhabitable during summer heat waves within only 83 years if climate change continues at its current pace. Meanwhile, a new separate study published by The Lancet says heat waves could kill up to 152,000 people a year across Europe by 2100. Europe is experiencing a sweltering, record-breaking heat wave this summer called Lucifer. Back in the United States, in Louisiana, torrential downpours flooded parts of New Orleans over the weekend, submerging cars, inundating homes and schools, forcing people to wade through hip-deep water in some neighborhoods. The flash floods overwhelmed New Orleans' sewage system. The head of the Sewage and Water Board, Cedric Grant, says the flooding was part of climate change.
The frustration is that we are now in a different era, in the era of climate change, where we have these kind of rains every week or every month. And it's not just us, it's the rest of the country that's experiencing the same weather patterns. We're in a situation where we now receive more rain than anybody could have imagined on a recurring basis.
On Friday, the Trump administration delivered an official notice to the United Nations saying it's withdrawing the U.S. from the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Accord. In Minnesota, the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington was bombed Saturday in an act that Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton has condemned as terrorism. The explosive device was thrown through the mosque office's window around 5 a.m. as people were gathering for morning prayers. No one was injured, but the bombing shattered windows and damaged the office. Most of the mosque's worshippers are members of suburban Minneapolis's Somali community. The FBI has taken over the investigation. President Trump has not said anything about the attack. Islamophobic attacks against Muslims and mosques across the United States have been rising since President Trump was elected. This is Hamdi El-Sawaf, president of the Islamic Community Center of Minnesota.
We assure those who do not have the consciousness of who we are, we will never come to our knees in front of them. We will keep resisting till we assure that the value of this country are in the highest level ever.
Yes.
It cannot be perpetrated by one individual or a group of people or a group of terrorists. We're here all together in order to defend the values of our country, the values of our faith, the values of our people.
A federal appeals court has thrown out the prison sentences of former Blackwater contractors who were involved in the 2007 massacre in Nisour Square in central Baghdad, killing 17 civilians when they opened fire with machine guns and threw grenades into the crowded public space. The attack by the Blackwater guards has been called the My Lai Massacre of Iraq. On Friday, the appeals court ruled three of the contractors could be resentenced, meaning their 30-year prison sentences could be dramatically shortened. A fourth contractor's murder conviction was thrown out entirely, meaning he'll now face a new trial. The United Nations Security Council has imposed a new round of sanctions against North Korea over its test launches of two intercontinental ballistic missiles last month. The sanctions ban North Korean exports of coal, iron, lead and seafood, which could slash up to one-third of North Korea's export revenue. North Korea slammed the sanctions as, quote, a violation of our sovereignty, unquote. Over the weekend, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met with China's foreign minister and other Asian leaders at a regional security meeting in the Philippines. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi called for dialogue to reduce the escalating tensions between the U.S. and North Korea.
Sanction is necessary, but sanction is not the ultimate purpose. Our purpose is to bring all parties involved in the nuclear issues back to the negotiation table, to find the resolutions through talks, to realize the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
In news from Washington, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said Sunday Special Counsel Robert Mueller can investigate any crimes he may discover within the scope of his probe into Trump's ties to Russia and whether his campaign colluded with Russians to sway the 2016 election. Rosenstein's comments came one day, only days after President Trump claimed it would be inappropriate for Mueller to investigate the Trump family finances. Mueller's impaneled a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C., giving the investigation the power of subpoena and opening the door to possible criminal charges against President Trump and his associates. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has promised an administration-wide crackdown on leaks, announcing the FBI has formed a new team specifically focused on investigating potential leaks to the press.
So today, I have this message for our friends in the intelligence community. The Department of Justice is open for business. And I have this warning for would-be leakers, don't do it. I've listened to our career investigators, FBI agents and others, and our prosecutors about how to most successfully investigate and prosecute these matters. At their suggestion, one of the things we are doing is reviewing policies for affecting media subpoenas.
On Twitter, Trump praised Sessions' speech, writing, quote, after many years of leaks going on in Washington, it's great to see the AG taking action. For national security, the tougher, the better, unquote. Trump's new chief of staff, General John Kelly, also warned staff over the weekend about leaks to the press, although his warning itself was promptly leaked. Multiple news outlets are reporting the Trump administration is considering naming senior policy adviser Stephen Miller to be the next communications director. Miller's well-known xenophobe and Islamophobe. He was the architect of Trump's first Muslim travel ban, and he's been praised by white nationalists, including Richard Spencer. If named, Miller would take over for former communications director Anthony Scaramucci, who was ousted after only, between 5 and 10 days on the job following an expletive-laced rant in which Scaramucci threatened to kill leakers and called former chief of staff Reince Priebus a paranoid schizophrenic. Civil rights groups have announced they will sue the Trump administration over the plan to ban transgender people from serving in the military. Trump announced the change last month on Twitter, seemingly without consulting top military officials. The battle between the Trump administration and sanctuary cities is escalating. Chicago has announced it'll sue the federal government for threatening to withhold $3.2 million in grants to the police department unless Chicago mobilizes its police to participate in the Trump administration's mass deportation plans. This is Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel.
Chicago will not let our police officers become political pawns in a debate. Chicago will not let our residents have their fundamental rights isolated and violated. And Chicago will never relinquish our status as a welcoming city.
We will discuss the crackdown on sanctuary cities, and particularly a Texas law about to go into effect, with Houston's police chief, Art Acevedo. In northern Afghanistan, up to 50 people were killed by Taliban and ISIS militants when the fighters attacked a police checkpoint and then entered a village, killing women and children. The Taliban had denied killing civilians, saying it killed only Afghan security forces and members of a pro-government militia. In Yemen, a U.S.-backed Saudi-led airstrike has killed at least 12 civilians, including women and children, sparking condemnation from the United Nations. The airstrike Friday killed at least 6 children when it struck their home in Saada province. In Syria, U.S. Marines and U.S.-led Syrian troops, backed by U.S.-led airstrikes, continue the campaign to seize control of the city of Raqqa from ISIS. The local journalistic group Raqqa is being slaughtered silently. Reports at least 6 civilians were killed during U.S.-led airstrikes on Raqqa Saturday. This comes as more information is emerging about a U.S.-led missile attack that killed up to 7 members of the same family August 2nd in Raqqa. Among the victims was 1-year-old Saad al-Shabsol, along with his grandfather. In Venezuela, authorities have quelled a right-wing anti-government paramilitary attack on a military base in Valencia. In a video message, armed men claimed the attack was a rebellion against the Maduro government. President Maduro has denounced the attack as U.S.-funded terrorism.
I can't say it another way. It is a terrorist attack against the armed forces, the Bolivarian National Army, and the armed forces responded in a united manner with morality and decisiveness. The bill for the attack was paid for from Miami and from Colombia. Marco Rubio has come out and said there was a military uprising in Venezuela and to support it.
The attack killed 2 people and came one day after Venezuela's controversial National Constituent Assembly held its first session. Critics say President Maduro is using the assembly, which will have the authority to rewrite Venezuela's constitution, to consolidate his power. Journalists and human rights groups are denouncing Israel's plan to shut down Al Jazeera's office in Jerusalem and revoke the press credentials of Al Jazeera's journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists called the shutdown undemocratic and said, quote, censoring Al Jazeera or closing its offices will not bring stability to the region, but it would put Israel firmly in the camp of some of the region's worst enemies of press freedom, unquote. Here in this country, Fox News host Eric Bolling has been suspended by the network. Amidst accusations, he's been texting unwanted photos of his genitals to female co-workers. He's the 3rd Fox News anchor to be suspended this year amidst Fox's sexual harassment scandal. In July, host Charles Payne was suspended after he was accused of coercing a female political analyst to have sex with him in exchange for a paid contributor's position. Former Fox News star Bill O'Reilly was fired in April amidst revelations that he and Fox News had paid out $13 million to settle lawsuits by 5 women who accused O'Reilly of sexual harassment and inappropriate sexual behavior. In Nebraska, hundreds of people rallied at the state capitol Sunday to protest construction of Keystone XL pipeline, which was resurrected by President Trump as one of his first acts in office. The pipeline has faced years of resistance from Native Americans, farmers, ranchers, landowners, and environmentalists. If completed, it would carry 830,000 barrels per day of tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, through Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska, where it would join an existing pipeline and carry the oil down to the Gulf. The United Auto Workers are accusing car manufacturer Nissan of running a vicious scare campaign against its effort to unionize a plant in Canton, Mississippi. On Thursday and Friday, the 3,500 workers at the plant voted against a bid to unionize. In sports news, multiple former football players spoke out against racism during Saturday night's Pro Football Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Former safety Kenny Easley said Black Lives Matter during his speech, while former running back LaDainian Tomlinson gave an emotional speech about his great-great-great-grandfather, George, who was kidnapped from West Africa and forced into slavery in the United States.
My great-great-great-grandfather, George. 170 years ago, George was brought here in chains on a slave ship from West Africa. His last name, Tomlinson, was given to him by the man who owned him. Tomlinson was the slave owner's last name. What extraordinary courage it must have taken for him to rebuild his life after the life he was born to was stolen. I'm of mixed race, and I represent America.
That was former running back LaDainian Tomlinson. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio says he'll push for a tax on wealthy New Yorkers in order to pay for essential upgrades to New York City's overstretched and ailing subway system, which has been engulfed in crisis this summer. The so-called millionaire's tax, which de Blasio is announcing today, will require approval from state lawmakers. And former hedge funder Martin Shkreli is facing decades in prison after being convicted of three counts of financial fraud Friday. Shkreli has been dubbed the most hated man in America after he hiked the price of a life-saving drug by more than 5,000% overnight. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Texas, where there's a growing concern that a new Show Me Your Papers law targeting immigrants is threatening public safety even before it goes into effect on September 1. Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed Senate Bill 4 into law in May, making it a Class A misdemeanor for local law enforcement officials to limit cooperation with federal immigration agents. The law orders police to comply with detainer requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement in their jails and also allows police officers to ask about the immigration status of anyone they detain, not just arrest.
In Houston, police say concern about the crackdown on immigrants has already led to a decrease in Latino victims reporting rape, even as rapes reported by non-Latinas increased. A judge could decide as early as this week whether to put SB 4 on hold. Meanwhile, a summer of resistance is underway by immigrants and their allies. This is 17-year-old Magdalena Juarez speaking during a quinceañera-themed protest at the state capitol in Austin.
When SB 4 goes into effect on September 1st, it will allow law enforcement to ask people who look foreign for their documentation. It will force public officials to enact Trump's mass deportation agenda and may make some victims of crime too scared of the law to seek help. The bottom line is SB 4 makes simply being brown illegal.
Texas' Governor Abbott has defended SB 4, saying it is meant to ensure public safety. But the Fort Worth Star-Telegram recently reported that a group of teenagers told police they carried out a string of robberies that targeted Latinos, quote, because they've got money and they don't call the police.
Well, today we'll look at what police who have to enforce SB 4 are saying about the law. This is an excerpt from a video report by The Intercept that features a formerly undocumented immigrant who's now a Houston police officer. He says he doesn't plan to ask people for their legal status.
My name is Officer Jesus Robles. I was born in Michoacán, Mexico, a little city called Jacona. I came to this country when I was a child. It took me over 20 years to finally get my citizenship. It's not as easy as people think. Most of us are out there to serve and protect. Most of us are not here with an agenda to be looking for immigrants or undocumented people. And most of us are not too excited about this whole situation because we do know that it's going to be a little more difficult to get cooperation from people on simple, simple things.
That report by Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz for The Intercept. Well, for more, we go to Houston, Texas, where we're joined by Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo. He's also vice president of the Major Cities Chiefs Association and co-authored an op-ed from Texas police chiefs that ran in newspapers statewide ahead of the vote on SB 4, headlined, "Do Not Burden Local Officers with Federal Immigration Enforcement." We're also joined here in New York by Renee Feltz, Democracy Now! Correspondent and producer who first covered the story for The Intercept headline, "Texas Police Say Show Me Your Papers Law is Damaging Public Safety Before Even Taking Effect." Her report for Rewire is headlined, "Texas Mayor's Police Officials Speak Out Against Immigration Law While They Still Can." We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Police Chief Acevedo, let's begin with you. You are the first Latino police chief of the most diverse city in the United States, Houston. This law has just been passed in your state, SB 4, that goes into effect on September 1st. You believe it hurts public safety even before it's gone into effect. Can you explain?
Well, because we're seeing it on the ground. You know, you just had Officer Robles on that works in a predominantly Hispanic community, and they are seeing people are hiding, they're moving into the shadows, and they're not cooperating. Even legal residents, lawful residents, U.S.-born citizens who might have, may have undocumented family members are starting to not want to cooperate, so they're afraid to be deported. So we're seeing it. The numbers speak for themselves. It's not just rapes that are not being reported. It's all violent crime. And through the second quarter of the year now, we're seeing the same trend. Words matter. The debate's been very mean-spirited, and I think people are running scared.
Well, Chief, when you talk about the numbers speak for themselves, could you go over some of those? We're seeing, you've seen an increase in reported rapes and crimes by non-Hispanics, but when it comes to Hispanics, there's been a sharp drop.
There's been a sharp drop in rapes and sexual assaults alone. The reduction has been 42.8%, while the rest of the community, the numbers have gone up. The same holds true to a lower, a lesser extent. I think about 13% increase with a decrease for all violent crime. And, you know, that's the unintended consequence. When you start trying to create the perception that frontline law enforcement officers should be focused on public safety are not going to become ICE agents, you cannot argue with the fact that it's going to have an impact. Perception matters, and the perception that SB 4 and the debate leading up to this law has created is that we are going to be required to be immigration agents, which that's not the truth. I mean, that's not a fact, but it doesn't matter. You cannot, we can't seem to convince the immigrant community that they need not to fear us.
I want to turn to the Texas House chamber in April during that debate on whether to amend SB 4 and let local police ask for the immigration status of anyone they detain, such as someone who reports a crime. This is Texas State Representative Mary Gonzalez addressing her fellow lawmakers before they vote after she just described her experience as a survivor of sexual assault.
I'm asking you to be as brave as me, who has survived it all and still made it here. I know it'll be hard sometimes back in your campaigns, and I get that political reality. But let me tell you this, it's harder sometimes to be a survivor. It's harder to know that the women and children who are gonna be affected by this will feel disconnected from law enforcement. To my friends on this floor, if you ever had any friendship with me, then this is the vote that measures that friendship. That you can vote for this amendment, then you think it's okay for women, for children, not to be able to go into law enforcement and be protected in their most vulnerable time in their lives? That you're willing to take that risk? Then I hope you never talk to me again, because this is people's lives.
Texas State Representative Mary Gonzalez, and after she spoke, they did, in fact, vote for that amendment. Police Chief Acevedo, can you talk about what you have seen and what she is talking about, very bravely speaking out as a survivor herself and a legislator? And then how, if you could explain in full what the overall law does.
Well, the law actually prohibits us from telling our officers they cannot ask out immigration status at the point of detention. And what we've seen is what we knew we would see, that folks are now not wanting to cooperate with law enforcement. And, you know, the unintended consequence is that today's witness or victim that may be undocumented, doesn't come forward, may not be able to help us prevent a future crime of another American-born resident, you know, whether that child at the bus stop that might get kidnapped, so on and so forth. And so, you know, there's a reason all of law enforcement came together here in Texas, all the big city police chiefs. We urge the party of law and order to not handcuff us, to not hurt our efforts. And despite our strongest words and editorials and everything else we did, they just ignored us. And so you can't be the party of law and order and then turn around and ignore labor groups in law enforcement and law enforcement leadership that together said no to SB 4, and it fell on deaf ears, sadly.
Renee, what are some of the nature of the challenges being raised by the NAACP, MilDef, and other civil rights groups about this law?
Well, It's interesting. We're seeing a summer of resistance. We don't always hear from police officers, and yet they're speaking out. And on the other side, we see a push in the courts by the American Civil Liberties Union, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. And what they're saying is this law violates the Constitution in several ways. Texans are big fans of the Second Amendment, but not necessarily the First in this case. They are perhaps restricting the right of public officials and law enforcement officials to speak out. What about the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable seizure? Police are concerned that immigrants who have a detainer put on them while they're in their jail are being held longer than they should be, violating their right to release, and in that regard, violating the Fourth Amendment. Then there's other amendments, for example, the Equal Protection Clause. Is this law targeting Latinos in Texas unfairly? And then finally, what about the law that struck down, that helped to strike down a similar law in Arizona, which is the Supremacy Clause, this idea that the federal government has the right to enforce immigration and states cannot determine that instead?
Now, although Chief Acevedo is speaking out against this law, activists are calling for police to take more steps against SB 4.
That's right. You know, they're calling for police to look at how a traffic stop can be a pathway to deportation. For example, if someone is stopped by a police officer in Texas and they're undocumented, they're not going to have a driver's license. They can't get one. Well, in that case, should an officer use discretion and let that person maybe have someone pick them up and take them home? Or should they be given—should they be arrested? Maybe they could be given a ticket or a citation and let go. Similar arguments have been made for young people who might violate a curfew or other incidents where there's petty offenses that are being carried out, similar to what police in other cities target under the broken windows or stop and frisk policies. They're saying make these policies ticketable offenses or give people a warning and let them go and reduce the number of interactions between police and immigrants that way.
And Chief Acevedo, what are you hearing from your officers out in the field about how this is going to affect their own police work in terms of the resources you have and the crimes that you have to deal with on a daily basis?
Well, let me tell you, police officers and labor groups and labor leaders and police chiefs sometimes don't agree on the time of day or the day of the week. In this instance, we were lockstep against this law because we have limited resources. We know that violent crime is starting to creep up nationwide in a lot of our big cities. And the last thing we need is to have a chilling effect on community policing. On community policing has been the cornerstone of the last 20, 25 years of policing. It's really led to historically low numbers in terms of violent crime. They don't want something put on the table, more for our officers to have to deal with. And most importantly, they want to not have that impact on the public that we serve and really rely on most to keep this community safe from not coming forward. And so there's when you see labor leadership and law enforcement and police chiefs together on something, that's really a clue. It's a hint. It means that it's probably not a good idea what we were going down this path. And sadly, unless the court intervenes, we have to be prepared to follow the law beginning September 1.
So, Chief Acevedo, explain exactly. You face yourself a $25,000 fine if what?
If I order my officers not to cooperate with ICE or limit their ability to actually ask the question. Now, but I'll tell you, you know, at the end of the day, racial profiling will not be tolerated. We can't tolerate it. And how you enforce this law without racially profiling is beyond many of us. So we'll see what happens. But our folks are well trained. They're focused. They want to keep Houston safe. And they know that going after, cooks and nannies and gardeners and people that buff for their immigration status don't bother anybody is not in the best interest. And it's something we're just not interested in.
Renee Felt.
Well, I just want to say in conclusion that as the police speak out, as the ACLU and MALDEF pursue this lawsuit, and as the summer of resistance continues, we're already seeing a downturn not only in people going to police, but even approaching social services, going to food banks. Studies have shown that the numbers are down there from immigrants as well. So we're talking about an issue of access to food in addition to services for young people. And the final point I wanted to make is that many people are expressing concern about the immigrant community coming forward to police. But many of these families, including those that I spoke to while I was in Houston, are from families with mixed status. So sometimes sometimes their parents have legal status and the children don't, and they're very concerned and afraid in the schools. And so so we'll see what happens with Judge Garcia's decision. It's a Clinton appointee, and hopefully we'll continue to follow this.
Chief Acevedo, I want to ask you one last question on a different issue. I wanted to get your response to President Trump's recent address to law enforcement officers on Long Island, New York, where he said this.
And when you see these towns and when you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody. Don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
So that was President Trump. While the police officers standing behind him at Suffolk Community College were applauding, he was slammed by a number of national police organizations for encouraging police brutality. Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo, your response to what he said.
Well, I mean, we already responded. We responded quickly as a profession. There's no room for the President of the United States to create the perception and feed that narrative that policing is we're a bunch of Neanderthals. We are committed to the rule of law, and the person needs to set the tones, the president. So we condemned those comments very quickly as a profession. And whether it's SB4 or police brutality, I'm proud of the fact that law enforcement today is going to be judged as being on the right side of history on these issues.
Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo, we want to thank you very much for joining us. And Renee Feltz, contributing reporter to The Intercept and Democracy Now!, will link to your piece. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Detroit and then to Charlottesville, Virginia, where white supremacists are planning a major rally for them this weekend. Stay with us. City Blues, Make Me Want to Holler by Marvin Gaye, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we turn now to look at Detroit, Michigan. 50 years ago this summer, a rebellion took place in the city streets. 43 people were killed. Thousands more were injured. Over 7,000 were arrested. More than 2,000 buildings were destroyed. Thousands of white families then fled the city, reshaping the makeup of Detroit. 50 years later, Detroit is being reshaped again, but under very different circumstances. Detroit is now 80% African American, and 40% of the city's residents live below the federal poverty line. But as downtown Detroit becomes increasingly gentrified, thousands of the city's longtime residents, mostly African American families, have lost their homes to foreclosure.
A recent study called State Graft found one in four Detroit properties have been subject to property tax foreclosure between 2011 and 15. And according to legal experts, many of the foreclosures may have violated the state's constitution. We go now to Detroit, Michigan, where we're joined by Bernadette Atuahine, a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law at the Illinois Institute of Technology and a visiting professor at Wayne State University Law School in Detroit. Along with her colleague, Timothy Hodge, she authored that study, State Graft. A recent op-ed piece in the New York Times is headlined, "Don't Let Detroit's revival rest on an injustice. She's with the Coalition to End Unconstitutional Tax Foreclosures. Democracy Now! Invited Detroit's mayor, Mike Dugan, to join us on the show, but we did not get a response. Tomorrow is the Detroit mayoral primary election. Professor Atuahine, thanks so much for being with us. Explain what you found in this report.
Yeah, there are three main findings. The first is that Michigan's constitution is clear in supporting legislation. No property should be assessed at more than 50% of its market value. Other state constitutions, to the extent that they measure, that they mention property tax assessments at all, say things like the property tax assessment must be fair, uniform, and equal, which means it's up to the judge to decide legality. But because the Michigan Constitution and supporting legislation specifically say no property should be assessed at more than 50% of its market value, it means people like me can come in and run the numbers and determine legality, and that's exactly what we did. So we ran the numbers from 2009 to 2015. And we found that in each of those 7 years, anywhere between 55 and 85% of properties were being assessed in violation of the Michigan Constitution, putting into disrepute the record number of property tax foreclosures in Detroit. The second finding is when we broke up the data into what we call five quintiles, quintile one is lowest valued homes to quintile five being the highest valued homes, we found that in quintile one and two, in the majority of those years, 95% or more of properties in quintile one and two were being assessed in violation of the state constitution. But then when you got to quintile five, which are the highest valued homes, the majority of those homes were being assessed, were not being assessed in violation of the state constitution. The third thing I want to bring to your attention is in Detroit, there's something called the poverty tax exemption. And as you mentioned, 40% of Detroiters fall below the federal poverty line. And in Detroit, if you fall according to the poverty tax exemption, you're not supposed to be paying taxes if you fall below the federal poverty line. But because the city failed to advertise the poverty tax exemption, because the city put several unnecessary barriers in the way, obstructing people from applying for the poverty tax exemption, we have a situation where people were illegally assessed, unable to pay the inflated taxes, foreclosed upon for taxes they weren't even supposed to be paying in the first place.
So, in other words, what your study found is that not only were most of the homeowners in Detroit being assessed at higher rates than the Constitution allowed, but that there was a disproportionate impact on the poorest households. What was the effect, the actual effect, then, on the people and the residents of Detroit?
Well, I can give you this story. The effect was they weren't able to pay those overinflated taxes. I can give you the story. There's lots of heartbreaking stories, but there's one particularly poignant story of Mr. Joseph Bates. His family had purchased his house. His great-grandfather purchased his house in Southwest Detroit in 1907. In fact, his grandfather was a chauffeur to Henry Ford himself. And that house was provided cover for five generations of the Bates family, which is five generations of working class Detroiters. Last year, that home was foreclosed upon and Mr. Bates was evicted from the home for non-payment of property taxes. The problem is that his home, his taxes, annual taxes, were about $1,300 per year, but his home was not worth more than $2,400 because it was severely dilapidated and it also, several of the rooms were unlivable. And in addition to that, Mr. Bates has worked in grocery stores his entire life. He's never made more than $10,000 a year, so he definitely qualified for the poverty tax exemption. But like several Detroiters, he didn't even know about the poverty tax exemption. And then even if he did, again, the various obstacles put in the way, unnecessary obstacles put in the way, means that he never applied for the poverty tax exemption. So Mr. Bates was evicted from a home his family has owned since 1907 for a non-payment of illegally inflated property taxes that he was not supposed to be paying in the first place.
Let's go to Joseph Bates in his own words. Again, as you say, his great-great-grandparents bought the house in 1907. He was ultimately foreclosed on last year.
I had diabetes for a couple of decades that I didn't know about. I didn't have health coverage, so young, I didn't think about it. So illnesses started happening. I could work less and less. So I ended up losing the house again because I couldn't keep up with taxes. Last year, a company bought my home in October on the Wayne County taxes. They bought my home at 1538 Junction. They went there, they came, they were the first time I had seen them. They said they were there to clean out the yard. I had no idea what was going on, and they told me that they had owned the house for years. I said there was no way they could have done that, because the taxes were coming in my name, you know, and everything. And so they came 2 weeks later, and they came with four people to throw me out. They told me to go to a homeless shelter.
So that was Joseph Bates describing at a news conference, along with a number of other people, the effect of these foreclosures. He ended by saying they told him to go to a homeless shelter. What is the remedy here, Professor Atuahene?
Well, several longstanding Detroit grassroots organizations have formed the Coalition to End Unconstitutional Tax Foreclosures, and there are three demands of the coalition. The first demand is to stop these unconstitutional tax assessments. The second demand is for those people who were already foreclosed upon and have already lost their homes to provide some kind of compensation. And the coalition hosted a people's forum on June 17th, which had over 100 people in attendance. We broke those people up into seven breakout groups with a trained facilitator and scribe and heard from them the things that they want. And two of the things that many people talked about is compensation, which we can use the hardest hit funds, which are federal funds currently used to demolish homes in Detroit. And we're saying let's repurpose that money because that program is under federal investigation. Repurpose that money to pay these illegally inflated taxes. And we also are saying the Detroit Land Bank owns 97,000 homes at the moment. 30 to 32,000 of those homes are residential properties. So give people a home, those who lost their home through these unconstitutional tax assessments. The third and final demand is on September 5th, the Wayne County Treasurer is about to foreclose on another round of houses this year. And we're saying, let's put a moratorium on tax foreclosures until we can ensure that delinquent tax owners have not been unconstitutionally assessed.
And briefly, could you give us your sense of the national news on Detroit is of a Detroit renaissance. And what is your message to people across the country of what is actually happening in Detroit as this week you head into a mayoral primary?
Yeah, I think that there is, in fact, a renaissance, but the sad thing about it is that, you know, Detroit is 143 square miles, and the renaissance is happening in 7.2 of those square miles. And in those 7.2 square miles, you have developers getting tax subsidies, tax breaks, and tax incentives that benefit people who are mostly newcomers to the city, while those long-standing Detroit residents who've stayed in Detroit after the Detroit riots, have stayed with Detroit through its hardest times, are now being subject to monumental tax injustice. And so the story of the revival, we need to really take a closer look at it.
And finally, the mayor, Mayor Duggan. How has he responded to your report?
So in January, the city finished a reassessment of all the residential properties in Detroit. And for the first time in 50 years, they're doing what they were legally supposed to be doing the whole time, which is assessing properties based on their current market value. So when they were rolling out the report, I was at the press conference and had an opportunity to ask him about unconstitutional tax assessments. And his response to me was that, well, if people believe that their assessments were unconstitutional, then they should have appealed those assessments. There are three problems with that statement. Number one, all the empirical evidence shows that more affluent homeowners are more likely to appeal their taxes. Less affluent homeowners are less likely to appeal and also less likely to be successful in their appeal. Number two, appeals processes are made for those unique cases because no system can get everything wrong. Right. No system can get everything right. And so an appeals process is designed for those unique cases where they got it wrong to get it right. An appeals process is not designed to correct systemic injustice, which is what is happening here in Detroit. As I said, anywhere from 55 to 85% of properties are being assessed in violation of the Michigan Constitution. Last but not least, you cannot possibly expect poor and working class Detroiters.
We just lost that satellite. Bernadette Atuehene is a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law, visiting professor at Wayne State University Law School in Detroit. We'll link to her piece in the New York Times, Don't Let Detroit's Revival Rest on an Injustice. She's with the Coalition to End Unconstitutional Tax Foreclosures. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we head south to Charlottesville, Virginia. Why are white supremacists rallying there this week? Stay with us. Young, performed by Mary Clayton here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we end today in Charlottesville, Virginia, where the city is bracing for a white nationalist rally on Saturday, protesting the planned removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from a downtown park. The Unite the Right event is expected to draw several thousands of people, including counter-protesters. In June, the KKK held a similar rally. More than 1,000 people joined that protest. After the hooded KKK members departed, police moved in and attacked the counter-protesters with tear gas and arrested 23 people. White nationalist Richard Spencer organized several similar protests earlier this year. City officials in Charlottesville have reportedly been looking at options to halt Saturday's Unite the Right event. A news conference is expected to take place later today to provide details about the plans for the rally.
Earlier this year, when the Charlottesville City Council voted to sell the statue of Robert E. Lee, white nationalist groups, including the Virginia chapter of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, filed a lawsuit against the city. A circuit court judge then issued a six-month injunction to halt its removal. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, at least 60 publicly funded Confederacy symbols have been removed or renamed since the 2015 massacre of 9 black parishioners in Charleston, South Carolina, by a self-described white supremacist. To find out more, we go to Charlottesville to talk to Wes Bellamy, vice mayor of Charlottesville, Virginia, youngest person ever to be elected to the Charlottesville City Council. He is also the only African-American city councilor and has been leading the opposition to the Robert E. Lee statue in the city. Wes Bellamy, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about your original push to have the Robert E. Lee statue taken down? And what you ultimately got that isn't talked about as much, which is some kind of funds for reparations.
Yeah. So this all started nearly a year and a half ago in March of last year. I received several different phone calls, emails. There was a petition from a local student here in the area about an effort and a push to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee. People in Charlottesville have been talking about this for some years, but just last year there was a nuance in a bill that was vetoed at the State House by our governor that essentially said that if you want to move these kind of statues and things of that nature, it's a local issue, so you have the right to be able to do so. My colleague and I, Ms. Kristen Sekos, we both decided to push really hard. We held a press conference in which there were probably about 150 people who came out, about 80, or excuse me, I would say about 110, 120 people or so who were pro moving the statue, and about 30 to 40 sons and daughters of the Confederacy who came with their large flags and very, very upset that we were pushing to do so. Subsequently, since then, there's been a lot of things that have transpired. I mean, I've received all kinds of death threats, been probably called every kind of N-word that you can think of, and it's been a very interesting topic. But I think that we have awakened, to say the least. We've seen a group of people here in our community who have been marginalized, who haven't necessarily had a voice. We're waking up, and we're saying that we are going to stand tall. And in the midst of all of this, we also got an equity package passed, which I presented in January before we had our first vote, and it was unanimously passed, which gave us $950,000 to our African American Heritage Center, $250,000 to build onto one of the parks in the local African American community. We got $2.5 million to public housing redevelopment, $50,000 annually for anyone who lives in public housing to get free GED training, another $50,000 to anyone who lives 80% below the AMI, which is the annual median income, as well as public housing, to have scholarships of sorts to go to our local community college. We got a position for Black Male Achievement, which we're calling a Youth Opportunity Coordinator. So, I mean, in all, it was about $4 million basically from funding put specifically into marginalized communities to help bridge the gap and create equity. All of this is about equity. We need equity and not equality. Those are two different things. Equity is giving everyone what they need in order to have the same playing field. Equality is just giving everyone the same thing. I don't want equality. I want us to have equity, and we're going to push for equity in every space, whether that's public parks, whether that's in our city budget, no matter where it is, as long as I'm on council, and I'm going to push for it until the day I die.
Well, Vice Mayor Bellamy, the interesting thing, though, is that you were offered the majority agreed to the equity package as a mm-hmm. as an attempted compromise to convince you to hold off on the removal of the Robert E. Lee statue. Could you talk about that effort on their part?
Yeah, so I think my colleagues, they wanted to see how we can find a compromise of sorts and move forward with the equity package. And I think I personally believe that all of my colleagues on council, they firmly also believe in equity. We may all have different ways in which we want to go about it. So we thought it was a great idea. When we had the first vote to move the statue, it's only five of us on council. It was a 2-2 vote, and one of my colleagues abstained. So it wasn't until our next city council meeting that Bob Fenwick decided to come on board and vote to remove the statue. So essentially, the statue was moved, or we had to vote to move the statue as well as getting the equity package.
And have you been surprised by the enormous backlash and these white supremacist organizing rallies in your town now?
No, sir. I'm a student of history. We see this is oftentimes what happened when you have specifically, let's just call a spade, when you have African-Americans who decide to stand up in non-traditional African-American places, in places in which we haven't been very vocal or in which we haven't, quote unquote, caused trouble or stirred things up. Whenever we decide to do so, and our white brothers and sisters, our Latino brothers and sisters, our brothers and sisters of different hues and persuasions decide to rally and ride with us, whenever you see that kind of uprising, the majority, and specifically individuals who believe that things should be the way they have always been, they normally push back. You've seen this from the 40s to the 50s to the 60s, and in no by shape, form, or fashion am I Dr. King or anything, but we've seen this kind of story and this playbook play out. There's always going to be met with opposition when you're doing something right. And I mean, the threats and the people who are saying they're going to do this and they're going to do that, and these rallies that have been coming about as of late, in my opinion, it just shows that we're doing something right. It's been troubling for many people in our community, but I think personally what I've often tell myself, and I tell the little kids who I talk to every single day and when we're walking around the city, in order for us to get to the clear water, the clean water, you have to go through the mud. And right now we're kind of in the muddy part, but I would much rather us go through the mud and get clean now than just pretend as if these issues don't exist and let's not do anything for another generation.
I want to turn to comments about the August 12th rally by the Unite the Right organizer, Jason Kessler, who posted the video on his Twitter account on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These people who are trying to erase white people from history. And that's the other question. Like, is this a white supremacist event? This is not a white supremacist event. This is a pro-white event.
Can you talk about those who are saying don't go to this, what Jason Kessler is saying, who he is, and also, did you vote to remove or sell the statue?
Yeah, so there's several questions that you asked there. You were breaking up a little bit, and I couldn't hear the first two. What did you say?
Who Jason Kessler is, and those who are saying, like the University of Charlottesville president, encouraging students not to go to this rally, concerned about violence.
Yeah, well, I believe that I have a ton of respect
it.
For. Yes, I have a ton of respect for Dr. Sullivan, and I agree. You know, if some individuals choose to not attend the rally, that's their choice. But one thing that I believe that is important for us to all understand is that we have to allow people to express themselves as they want to. The same way that Mr. Kessler has the opportunity and he has the right to be able to express himself, other individuals have that same right. And if they choose to go to the rally, I don't want to get into a position in which I'm telling people, don't go and say anything. Don't go and counter protest, because what we saw from the event that occurred on July 8th is that there are a lot of people from different persuasions. There are professors, there are people who live in the community, there are people who normally never protest, can be meek and they can be solemn. We have clergy people, all feel as if it's important for them to voice their opinion and voice their opposition. So again, I don't want to get into a point in which we tell people not to do so. As for Mr. Kessler, he is who he is. I don't have any ill will or anything to say towards Mr. Kessler. I actually went to church yesterday and we had communion and I forgave Mr. Kessler. So, I mean, he is free to do what he wants to do. But as far as I'm concerned, we do have an obligation and a duty to keep people safe and make sure that everyone is protected. But I do want to encourage people, if you want to stand up and you want to speak out in whatever way you choose to do so, I respect you and I empathize with the fact that you want to do that.
Well, you've been having several meetings of your council to try, closed-door meetings largely, to try to figure out how to handle the events that are coming up this Saturday. There was some talk of possibly moving the rally. What's been some of the discussion that you've had behind closed doors?
Well, legally, we can't discuss anything that we've been talking about behind closed doors or in any of our closed sessions. Sorry about that.
And this question of selling the statue or removing it?
Well, in regards to selling the statue, what we agreed to do was create a RFP, request for proposal, after the injunction is over, for individuals, or excuse me, for entities. It's a very nuanced language, who may be, for example, a park service or a locality or a museum or things of that nature. They will have the opportunity to be able to purchase the statue. And it's not necessarily an auction, but some people have been describing it as an auction. The thing is this. We don't want to desecrate or dismantle or disrespect the statue in any shape, form, or fashion. I don't have any personal problems with Robert E. Lee. He is who he is, and I am who I am. But what we do believe is that that statue doesn't belong in the middle of our downtown, especially if we're a community in which we're trying to provide equity and we say that we're one of the best places to live in the country for all people. Then we have to make sure that we maintain safe spaces in our parks for all people. So in terms of selling the statue or auctioning it off, we just believe that it should be in a more appropriate place. So if there's a park service or if there is a civil rights museum, excuse me, a Civil War museum or somewhere in which individuals believe that they can pay the proper homage and respect to Mr. Lee through a government entity or something of that nature, then they have every right to auction off, or excuse me, purchase the statue. And we've received several calls for it.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Wes Bellamy, for joining us. Vice Mayor of Charlottesville, Virginia, youngest person ever to be elected to the Charlottesville City Council, the only African-American currently on that council, leading the opposition to the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville, Virginia, the home of Thomas Jefferson. That does it for the show. If you'd like to sign up for our Daily Digest email list, get our headlines every day and news alerts, just text the word Democracy Now! Without a space, Democracy Now! To 66866. And you can get behind-the-scenes updates and stories from Democracy Now! On Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and more. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gattis, Dana Sanakoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Honey Masood, Trina Dura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
This is another old song. It's off that same record from a while back. It's called South of America. This dog's calling awfully out here. This cat's with their mouths filled with tears. And there's black water curling